Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your questions and emails. Wow, what more could you ask for here on Ask Dr. Dawn? Well, that'll be up to you. In a moment, I'll be giving out the phone numbers, but before I do that, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Let's start with an email from Mary, and she wants to know about a friend of hers who is taking, well, she's concerned about whether they're taking too much Vicodin. How much is too much? A Vicodin is hydrocodone and acetaminophen. And the hydrocodone, which is a codeine-like substance in the opiate family, is a narcotic, technically, and has some dopamine reward-generating factors to its mechanisms in the brain and can thus be addictive. The problem really is that by being mixed with the acetaminophen, the hydrocodone is the thing that gets people to take the drug, and the acetaminophen is toxic to the liver. A standard Vicodin pill contains 500 milligrams of acetaminophen, and we know that more than 4,000 milligrams of acetaminophen will, on the average, be toxic to the liver. Now, that's on the average. Some people will be able to tolerate more, but unfortunately, some people will actually tolerate much less due to inherent weaknesses in their enzyme systems. The way that works is that in the first phase and second phase detoxification of acetaminophen, in phase one detoxification, a toxic intermediate is formed, something that is actually damaging to the liver. Now, this needs to be dealt with as soon as possible by conjugation. But if your conjugation is slow, you're much more likely to have problems with acetaminophen toxicity. In general, therefore, 8 Vicodin a day would be the upper limit on what would be safe for a person to use, the average person. And again, like I said, some people may be much more vulnerable. All bets are off if you're taking other drugs, particularly using alcohol, which further slows down the second phase detoxification of acetaminophen. So it is very dangerous for someone to be taking this on a regular daily basis for long periods of time, and especially if they're doing it for recreational purposes. Hope that helps. Let's go to another email. This one from Patricia in Boulder Creek. I take omega-3, which thins your blood, and I'm wondering if I start taking aspirin at 325 milligrams, should I cut back on omega-3 dose or take a baby aspirin? I take omega-3, 1,100 milligrams of fish oil, and 500 milligrams total of EPA and DHA. Well, if you're already taking 1,000 milligrams of omega-3 fatty acids, it's probably true that you have some thinning of your blood, some reduction in the strength of your platelets due to the fact that a compound called thromboxane, which is important for clotting, is a little bit weaker when it's made from omega-3 fatty acids as its basic material than whether it's made from the omega-6 fatty acids, which are the more common one found in, let's say, any form of vegetable oil that you might name, with the exception of olive and canola oil. So I would say a baby aspirin would probably be proportionate for someone who's already taking a fair amount of fish oil. This is a estimation. It's an educated guess. It is not supported by research. And we don't know, and the research has not been done, looking head-to-head at aspirin versus, say, 2,000 milligrams of omega-3 fatty acid per day in a long-term study looking at heart attack prevention and looking at stroke prevention. So we simply don't know what the ideal dose is. And again, even if we did have an average number to give you, because of the variations from individual to individual, even if we may have a very good idea what the average dose should be, homing in on the correct dose for a single individual is virtually impossible. It's all a matter of educated guesswork, ultimately. And let's go to our first caller. And that is Jerry in Santa Cruz. Hello, Jerry, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I just got back from traveling in India for 6 weeks. Didn't get sick once. had a some lab work done to check my blood and stool, and everything was fine. But something came up on the trip which still is very much in my life. In the United States, we mostly had North Indian food, and on the second or third day I went there, we went to a South Indian restaurant. And I noticed after the meal that my tongue just sort of felt a little bit numb, like when you burn your mouth on a hot pizza. And I thought it was just the salsa, which I had a lot of. And then we went about 3 or 4 days later to the same restaurant, and I noticed that the inside of my cheeks felt funny and that I was thirsty all the time and could never get enough drink. And I thought, well, that's sort of an interesting thing to have happen. We traveled, came back to Delhi, and went to the same restaurant again. And this time we had a very late dinner, 8 or 9 o'clock at night, and I woke up at 2 in the morning with a funny feeling at the very top of my throat. And I thought that maybe I was getting the same cold that one of my friends had. I didn't fall back asleep. And around 3, I realized, in fact, that my tongue was swelling a lot.
I thought this is where you were going with this.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. And so I found that if I lay down on my back, I couldn't breathe very well. But if I sat up, I could breathe fine. And so I watched it, trying to see what would happen, knowing about food allergies. And around 4 o'clock, it pretty much flattened. It tapered off in terms of change. My tongue was still pretty big, but it didn't seem to be getting any worse. So I went back to sleep. And at 7 when I woke up, it was hard to keep my tongue in my mouth. I kind of looked like a hot, tired basset hound, I think, and couldn't talk very well. We had some large antihistamines there, and I took one, and by 2 in the afternoon, everything had pretty much gone back to normal in terms of swelling. My lips had sort of felt like I'd been hit in the mouth, like I had Botox, and the insides of my cheeks had gotten puffy, but mostly it went away by 2 in the afternoon. 3 or 4 weeks went by. The last day I'm in India, and we said, let's go out for a late lunch. My flight left that night, and I said, you know, I've never had any food allergies at all, and it must have just been the salsa. Let's go to South Indian instead, and I won't eat any salsa. I had the blandest food they had there. That was at 4 in the afternoon. On the way to the airport at 8:30 at night, I said, you know what, we need to go to the emergency room. And I got there. My tongue was swelling. I did not want to be at 35,000 feet.
I am so glad you made that decision. I have this real serious luck lately, the last few years. Whenever I travel over a large ocean, about halfway over, someone on the plane gets sick. And I have to try to figure out what to do. And I used to bring a first aid kit with me before the Homeland Security thing. Now I can't bring anything worthwhile, and the airplane kits are terrible. So I'm really glad that you didn't get on that airplane. You could have died. You needed some epinephrine. I presume you got it.
So what they gave me was a cortisone shot, IV, and some antihistamine.
I bet they gave you some epinephrine, too. You had an allergic reaction. The technical term for that facial swelling and tongue swelling is angioedema. And it can swell lower down and completely block your airway. So you have now had this reaction on several occasions to a particular cuisine and not to Indian food in this country. So,
or not Indian food there, except for South Indian.
The point is that there is something that is used at that restaurant, possibly in all South Indian cuisine, possibly just in that restaurant, or uniquely to whatever version of the product they were using in that restaurant. You don't know what it is. So you can probably narrow it down a little bit the next time it happens to you, because it's really likely it could happen again. Then you get the breakdown of everything that was in that meal that you've eaten that triggered it. And hopefully after several iterations, you'll be able to eliminate things, because it's like, okay, I know I can eat that. I know I can eat that. You're looking for the difference between Indian food in that one restaurant and all of the other Indian food you had in your life, and it's going to take supreme detective work. You might try getting just standard spice testing. You know, you can do allergy testing, but the trouble is we don't know what specific substance to test for, and you don't have a background history of lots of food allergies. So in this circumstance, I think I would advise that you do get an EpiPen, which is an epinephrine pen, and have it available, because unfortunately the next reaction could be massive and very dangerous, it could be nothing. It could be trivial.
Can they narrow it to spices? Because I had the most bland thing. It's potatoes and mixed vegetables. A number of Indian friends still in Delhi said, oh yes, this happens all the time. And they said it's the coconut, but I've had coconut since I've been back. And it's not that.
Well, maybe it's something about that coconut. I mean, all coconuts are not created equal. I can't tell you what it is, but it's something. And it just is one of those phenomenon where even if you knew what it was, you wouldn't necessarily be able to be certain that you were avoiding it. So I would get the EpiPen.
Really?
Yeah, you have a vulnerability, just like someone who has this after a bee sting.
So then there's a different question, and that is that I have no taste in my mouth at all. I can put a teaspoon of sugar on my tongue, and I know it by texture, but not by taste.
Right, your papillae have gotten damaged by that reaction that you had. So not only did you start to have a systemic reaction, but you had a very rampant local reaction, and it's taken out the papillae, the taste buds. They will probably regenerate. Call it 3 to 6 months.
Oh, I'm a foodie.
Well,
3 months without tasting.
I don't know it'll be that long, but yeah. I'm just saying if it goes longer than that, then you need to be really worried about it and seek medical attention. But I think it could go up to 3 to 6 months and still come back.
My salivary glands also are confused.
Yep. Yeah. Because you just had a forest fire in there, my friend.
And I have extreme salty taste in my mouth all the time.
It'll get better.
Really?
It'll get better.
I feel like I've just drunk seawater.
It'll get better. But,
okay.
But it definitely, this is not good for your body, whatever that stuff was.
So I have to find out what it was and or carry an EpiPen.
You have to carry an EpiPen.
Really?
Even if you knew what it was, how could you guarantee you wouldn't be exposed again?
Yeah.
And if you're exposed and it kills you, it's like, I think I want the EpiPen.
Right.
You could put it in the summer, you can't keep it in the car, but otherwise you could keep it in the car. You really should have access to it, or if you're married and your wife carries this typical mega purse, she could carry it for you.
So when I go to the grocery store, I bring it with me? Or
only when I'm eating? Only when you're eating.
Okay.
And probably not a seriously big issue unless you're going out to ethnic restaurants, right? Because you've lived your whole life without having
right.
it.
Right. Never had a response like that. Okay.
All
As
right.
As always, thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We had an off-air comment regarding the first caller. Indian food often contains mango and or cashew. That's true, as spicing. And these are common allergens. Parenthetically, though, I wouldn't expect a common allergen to be the problem in the case of that caller, just because if it were a common allergen, he should have encountered it multiple times here in the United States and had the opportunity to develop a reaction. So the fact that it was so specific to that one restaurant really does make me wonder about maybe something unique to that place or unique to the brand of salt or whatever that they were using, you know, something really specific. And we had an off-air comment back on the gentleman with the food allergies. He was apparently caught a little bit of a zeitgeist there on that one. Another caller suspects it's coconut. It depends on how they prepare the coconut. She's heard of cases where coconut can be toxic if done wrong. Well, I'm not Lynn Rosetta Casper, and this isn't the Splendid Table, but if you know something about that, and would like to call in and tell us more about toxic coconuts and food reactions, I'd love to hear it. Going now to PB in Santa Cruz. Hello, PB. How are you?
Hi.
Hi.
I'm just curious about the thing that a friend told me. First of all, she said that you could look like a female but have male chromosomes, which I'd never heard anyone say before.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And if that's true, what I was wondering is, anyone able to do transplants and make someone who's biologically, say, female, male?
Well, what does it mean to be male? When you say biologically female, are you talking phenotype or genotype? Let me explain the difference. There's what it says in the genes versus what it looks like to the naked eye. And the naked eye is phenotype. You know, the microscopic view is the genotype. So what does it mean
right.
to be, when you say biologically, do you mean a genetic female or a phenotypic female?
What I mean is that you would have self-sustaining hormone systems happening so that you wouldn't have to take hormone pills. You would have functioning genitalia. You would have,
Yeah, I understand. I see what you're saying. From a practical standpoint, we do not yet have the technology to take, let's say, male testes and transplant them into a sac that we create in a groin of a phenotypic female and get those testes hooked up to a blood supply to be producing testosterone. Okay, we don't yet have that kind of technology. If you set yourself to the problem of of making a situation as if that had happened. In other words, provided a source of testosterone, maybe in the form of an injection or a medical device that was under the skin that just leaked testosterone into the bloodstream, you could Right. produce masculinization in a phenotypic female. And what you would get would be increased body hair, lowering of the voice, you'd get some enlargement of the clitoris. So you'd get changes in the direction of maleness. But if you start out with an adult, too many things have kind of set permanently for you to change into something that would resemble a naturally produced male. You have to do these sorts of things back early on when you're dealing with an infant, when things have not yet settled down and developed momentum and grown in a certain way. Testicular feminization is the term for people who lack a testosterone receptor. So they make testosterone, but there's no receptor to acknowledge it. So the person develops physically as if he were a female, and it looks like a female, except that there are high levels of testosterone and this person's not fertile.
What I'm wondering about, well, it's complicated, but part of the issue is that I was premature because my mother decided to take an antibiotic, a strong one, when I was in utero, and I was an Rh baby. I'm Rh positive. My mother was Rh negative.
Right. Okay.
So I was born without, enough antibodies and in crisis.
Right.
They told my mother, in fact, that I would not live. So she was prepared for a dead child, and I surprised everybody and made it. But my hips are really, really narrow, and a doctor told me there was no way I would ever have children, probably. He didn't even think I could get pregnant the normal way, unless I did scientific intervention.
Okay.
So there are things about the body that are more masculine.
Right.
The muscles are much larger than normal for female.
So you're wondering whether or not you could be genetically male? Is that your question?
Yeah, and whether or not it could be medically dealt with so that I could be fully male and not just in this limbo in between.
Well, I presume that you have standard issue looking female genitalia, right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So there's the way to make you quote unquote into a male. Wouldn't matter what your genetics were, really.
Okay.
It would be the standard sexual reassignment procedures, protocols that we have, which involve, for a female-to-male transition, they involve giving testosterone and surgery. And, of course, there's lots of psychological tests and batteries that you have to go through to qualify for that type of rather drastic surgery. But, nevertheless, that is an option open to you. You could find out about your genetics by simply having a smear done of the inside of your mouth. And there's a difference in the way that female and male cells look. Because women have two X chromosomes, they shut down one of them. And that shut down chromosome you can stain for and see in a regular nucleus of a cell. And it's called a bar body, B-A-R-R. So you can look for bar bodies in just a cheek swab. And it's done all the time because back in the 1960s and 70s, the Soviet bloc countries started giving lots of testosterone, and some of their athletes that were female competing in the female divisions looked male, and they started basically making sure that they really were female. It was kind of...
Yeah,
I know.
Got it.
Yeah, so...
I got it.
So it's kind of... That testing is very relatively easy to do and inexpensive, and so that would be open to you as a start. What you feel inside, I mean, this gets into a whole topic of psychological sexuality versus what your phenotype is, but who you feel yourself to be inside as your identity, in my opinion, is who you need to be. And if you identify yourself as male, even if you have a set of female genitalia, then you need to try to move to be true to your heart and move to be being male, although it will be artificial. There's no transplant at this point.
Why not, though? I mean, that seems kind of odd. They can transplant arms and legs and parts. And
You know, if somebody could do a penis transplant, they would get so rich. I mean, think about it.
Well, yeah.
Think about
That's
it.
Why I'm surprised.
Although
nobody has done it.
Yeah, but it's technically difficult. That's a very, very complex blood supply you're talking about here. And the regulation of the blood supply is even more complex. We don't have time to get into the mechanisms of the male erection this show, but it's a fascinating cascade of loops, neurological feedback loops, and it goes wrong a lot, as most people have firsthand experience of. And when it does go right, it's pretty amazing. And transplants? No, hasn't happened. And I think will be one of the later things that we manage to transplant. Blood supplies are tricky.
I just wondered if maybe there's a research scientist somewhere that's working on it. There must be.
You know, I would Google it. Penis transplant.
Oh, good idea.
Yeah, and just go looking. See, I mean, you'll probably find all kinds of weird stuff, but believe me.
Yeah.
But somewhere in there may be some research. I would probably try scholar.google and then, you know, transplant, genitalia transplant, and see what you find.
I am right in thinking that the fetus develops the more female appearance and then the male stuff comes last.
That's right.
That's right.
By about 8 weeks of gestation, you know, certainly by 12 weeks of gestation, there's enough physical changes down there in the groin that you can reliably sex a male to a female pretty reliably.
I was just guessing that because the fetus was under attack from my mother's body, apparently, and then she took the antibiotic, which made the situation much worse.
Mm-hmm.
Guessing that the body was just trying to finish me and get me out of there.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of times preemies, particularly preemies who are stressed, have low birth weight, and they will often be small, and the narrow pelvis would kind of go with that.
Right, and apparently I was somewhat ambiguous when I was born.
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah, and that would make sense.
So that was my guess.
Okay,
just assigned me one way, and it shouldn't have been like that. And I'm trying to figure out my options now.
According to my producer, actually, the first successful penis transplant was actually done at a military hospital in Guangzhou, China. It was a brain-dead donor, and the patient had had an industrial accident. And I have no details about whether it was functional after the transplant. I have my doubts, but nonetheless, it has been done. So I'm wrong when I said it hasn't been done. I definitely don't think it's done here in the United States.
So there is some hope. I just know I don't want to live a life on hormones, et cetera.
You mean artificial hormones. You mean artificial hormones. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well,
I just don't want to be I don't want to be a Frankenstein. You know, I don't want to be a creation like that. If it's possible to do it in a biologically natural way, great. Otherwise, I'll have to give it up.
I think at this point, you've got to follow your path, but it won't be natural. It'll be a big stretch and a lot of technology to get there. So it may not be your path.
Yeah, maybe not. Anyway,
good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
You're
good
welcome.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Speaking of which, actually, something really specific and weird before we go to our next caller. This is the first known case of food contamination coming from the food packaging. The story goes something like this. Researchers were looking at estimates for the amount of PBDEs. These are fire retardants that are used in circuits, and they're used in a lot of electronic devices. They're in fabrics. They're in insulation. It stands for polybrominated diphenyl esters. And anyway, these PBDEs are in trace amounts in food. So they were just researching, you know, amounts in butter. And they went to a bunch of grocery stores and they bought 10 different samples of butter and brought them back to the lab. One of the samples contained 135 times the amount of PBDE than the other samples. And they were like, what's up with this? Then they checked the wrapper, and the paper wrapper on the butter had 16 times that. So we're talking about roughly four orders of magnitude more PBDE in the paper wrapper on this butter than on the amount that is usually found in butter. So this is probably not the first time this has happened. And I hope that they trace back how that stuff got in that paper and how common this is. But this was complete accident, and it reminds me of that story from about 4 years ago when the BPA was discovered to be something that could leach from the hard plastics like the Lexan bottles. And it was like, oh my good, Nalgene bottles can leach BPA into substances. That means BPA can get into food. That would explain all the BPA levels that we've been seeing. And, you know, 3 or 4 years later, it's now outlawed in baby food and baby bottles. So I wonder where this is going to go. This could be the beginning of a very, very big, deep iceberg. So stay tuned. Let's go now to our next caller. And that is Nancy in Santa Cruz. Hello, Nancy, and welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. What are people supposed to do now that Darvon's taken off the market if you have the cytochrome P450 genetic marker?
Sorry, which cytochrome P450 genetic marker do you mean? There's a bunch of them.
Well, it's the one where, you, for instance, you can't have like codeine or any of the like the normal, a lot of those normal drugs for pain.
Okay, so you have, right, so that's the 34A mutation, I think.
Off
the top of my head, I'm not certain, but I think that's the right one. What are you going to do? Well, you will not be able to use the codeine or the hydrocodone derivative, so you'll be looking at the atypical opiates like tramadol. See, Darvon was taken off the market because of cardiac side effects, and it's an old drug, and it's actually fairly common to see in elderly patients with pain. It's a little less addicting than hydrocodone, not by much, but somewhat. And so a lot of doctors used it for preference, but now it's no longer available, and we just have to kind of like it or lump it. We don't have an option. For people like yourself, more expensive drugs, but drugs that are newer are available, that are opiate ligands that go through a different enzymatic pathway for breakdown. So that's kind of the situation. Yeah.
Okay, the Darvon always worked really well for me. So what is this one you're talking about, Tramadol?
Tramadol, T-R-A-M-A-D-O-L. Ultram is the trade name for that drug.
Okay, well, I guess that's my question there.
All right, well, I hope I've been helpful.
All right, thank you.
Bye, Nancy. A couple of interesting little science tidbits in the news. Osteoporosis drugs. Latest consensus is emerging that the long-term use of bisphosphonates is probably undesirable. And by long-term, we're talking about 10 or 15 years. The longer you use it, the more side effects we're starting to see. And also the more the protection seems to wane in terms of fractures. So current consensus, which is, again, an argument, always consensus is a draw. No one ever walks away from a consensus feeling fully satisfied. But many bone specialists now are stopping the bisphosphonates for a year. And the interval, is it 5 years? Is it 6 years? Is it 10 years? That one's up for grabs. But most do feel that if you interrupt therapy for 1 year, enough bone repair can take place that the two most common side effects, which are the osteonecrosis of the jaw and the admittedly quite rare midshaft femur fractures, will have a chance to repair themselves. So useful to know. The cancer of the esophagus piece that's associated with the bisphosphonates has to do with the fact that they are very damaging when they're belched up. And so it's a statistical risk. Bisphosphonates shouldn't be used in people with heartburn. End of discussion. And this always gets people's attention. A new prescription diet pill is probably going to be coming out. The FDA Food Advisory Panel voted 13-7 this week to approve a new drug called Contrave. This drug was developed by Orexigen Therapeutics of San Diego, and it is actually a combination drug of two older drugs, which is always interesting. The older drugs are bupropion, which is sold under the brand name Wellbutrin, and also under the name Zyban. It's used to help people quit smoking, and doctors have long noted that it has some mild anti-compulsive eating, anti-addictive eating types of effects, probably affecting the dopamine reward pathway and blunting that a little bit. That seems to be what smokers report. The other drug, naltrexone, is used to treat alcohol and drug addiction. And at the doses typically used for that, it can cause nausea and some malaise. So I wonder if that isn't part of the benefit. Perhaps there's some sort of synergy. Certainly they were able to show that people, let's see, lost an average of 4.2 percentage points of their weight over a year's time while taking the pill compared to placebo. So they did go ahead and approve it, even though that was marginal in terms of benefit. It will certainly be a boon if it is effective. The side effects primarily are on the bupropion end, and about 10% of people who take that medication will experience anxiety. However, unlike Meridia and the Fenfen that was pulled from the market some years ago, no concern about heart valves has ever emerged, and their cardiac issues are probably not significant. and raising blood pressure, again, not a big issue. And we do have lots of clinical experience with these drugs. So I'd say a qualified positive. Be interesting to see what happens when this gets deployed wide scale, which it's almost certain to be. And let's go to Roxanne in Santa Cruz. Hello, Roxanne. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
I'm calling to ask you a question. I'm using acupuncture for blood pressure control.
Yes.
Medical doctors have never been able to contain my blood pressure. They piggyback drug after drug after drug. And the lowest they ever get me is around 175.
Right.
I can't remember what the lower number is, but it's high. It's 100 plus.
Okay.
And I'm there now with acupuncture just after a few weeks. And the doctor said something really interesting to me, and I wanted to ask you about it. He said, we probably won't take you much lower than 175 because people that have chronic high blood pressure, really high, don't feel good when they're much lower than 175. And I wondered what you thought of that. I mean,
well, in the short term, I think you don't want to bring people down quickly.
Okay.
And so I disagree with the statement in the long term, but I agree with it in the short term.
Maybe that's how he meant it.
Yeah, I think he probably did. In the long term, your goal is to get people down to 135 over 75, ideally. That's the sweet spot.
Okay. Yeah.
At that point, increased drops don't buy you much benefit. But above that, you do see a significant benefit in event rates like heart attacks or strokes. So we strive to get down to 135 over 75.
Okay, because weight loss, nothing has done it for me.
And indeed, it may not, because there are a lot of physiologic changes that take place over time once you are hypertensive that tend to perpetuate the hypertension. The best time to reverse hypertension is the first time you find it. And at that point, you take the person to a lifestyle modification treatment, exercise, 5 to 7 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, lots of magnesium, all sorts of things aimed at improving their lifestyle. And a lot of times, if you catch them early, you can get the blood pressure back down. And then as long as they maintain those lifestyle changes, the blood pressure stays down.
Oh, okay. Well,
but I think it might be too late for you for that. Yeah. So you're now at the point where you're doing damage control and you're probably going to need to continue on medications. But most important, I think, for you is to do it slowly, because the blood vessels that go to your brain are used to being constricted because they are trying to protect your brain from too much pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And if you suddenly drop the pressure on those blood vessels, not enough blood will get to your brain. And that's what your doctor's talking about.
Okay, now I'm not taking medication. I'm just doing acupuncture.
And the pressures that you're achieving with the acupuncture are?
I'm at 175 now after 3 weeks.
That's an improvement.
And usually I can be on drugs, Western drugs, for close to 6 months before they see any improvement. I mean, close to 3 months before I see any improvement.
Right. And it depends on the drug, what the latency is for improvement. So I think you might want to look into combined therapy.
Oh.
Using perhaps some of the more safe hypertensive drugs, like perhaps an angiotensin receptor blocker, which is nice. It helps protect your kidneys from the effects of the hypertension. Generally very well tolerated drugs, now available as generic, so cost is reasonable. And something like that, perhaps with your continued acupuncture, would be the best of both worlds.
Oh, I never thought of that.
A long-term goal, I would say, would be to shoot for the 140s on that upper number.
Okay.
Okay.
I wanted to thank your assistant who answers the phone was the person who suggested acupuncture to me. So,
well,
I just want to thank him because I do feel so much better.
Thank you, Charlie. All right. Have a good day.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's talk to Virginia in Boulder Creek. Hello, Virginia.
I would like to ask a question about geographic tongue.
Okay.
My grandson has it. He's only 14 months old, and he's having some trouble gaining weight. I wonder how much that has to do with it. Just talk to me about geographic tongue, please.
All right. Well, in order to talk to you at all about geographic tongue, I'll first define it for the audience. And it's where the tongue looks kind of like the map of the world, where there are continents, kind of unusual random shapes and blotches with sharp borders that resemble white and red depiction of the globe. and hence the term geographic tongue. In conventional medicine, it means absolutely nothing and is completely ignored.
Exactly.
In Chinese medicine, it is considered to map to the internal organs. So there's a part of the tongue that corresponds to the lungs, a part of the tongue that corresponds to the liver, a part of the tongue that corresponds to the spleen, and the color of the geographic continents, if they are white versus yellow, if they are thick versus thin, all has a diagnostic significance. So you would want to take your grandson to a Chinese medicine specialist and have a diagnosis made in terms of which organ systems are affected here.
Ah.
And then you might want to work with a doctor who's got experience with pediatric TCM. I would certainly look for a pediatric specialist because the use of herbs, for example, in children is definitely different than in adults, and one has to be very careful what one gives to children in whatever medical modality you're talking about. For example, if the tongue showed that there was a thick yellow discharge in the area of the spleen and the stomach in the context of a male infant who was having trouble gaining weight, you might want to use drugs that would cool the stomach qi. And there is a whole host of herbs that have that property in within the Chinese pharmacopoeia. I do not have that expertise personally, but I know who to ask.
Oh, good. If I call you at your office and ask, would that be all right?
Actually, I would simply recommend calling Five Branches,
acupuncture
college that's actually coincidentally right here around the corner from the radio station. And make an appointment. I think they have a pediatric clinic. And just come in and say, you know, what does this suggest?
Thank you.
All right. Good luck.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Just when you thought it was settled. Estrogen is bad, right? Causes breast cancer, right? Well, recent major study coming out and making a huge splash at a conference just recently. Researcher is Joseph Ragaz, R-A-G-A-Z. What he found was that breast cancer incidence in women who did not have a strong family history of breast cancer, who only took estrogen hormone replacement therapy, no progesterone, was actually lowered compared to women who took no hormone replacement therapy. Let me repeat that, because it's one of those everything you know is wrong statements. The Women's Health Initiative was, in fact, deeply flawed, and part of the flaw was the way that they designed the study. But in 2007, other researchers went in and looked at the data who didn't have an axe to grind against estrogen, and they found that even in the Women's Health Initiative, women using combination hormone therapy for less than 5 years did not have an increased risk in breast cancer. So it was a very small increase. It took more than 5 years. And now we have someone coming along and saying, you know, the problem was all in the medroxyprogesterone. And, you know, I'm going to go and dig up the editorial that I did back in 2002 about this and post it. I'll either post a transcript or I'll post the recording if I can find it. Because I said exactly this after I read the original report. It was there if you cared to look at the data. And I didn't even need a calculator. I could get it off of the tables that they used and the way the study was designed. Well, it took 10 years, but 8 years. But now more people are turning around and saying, you know what? It's not the estrogen, it's the progesterone. Oh, no. You mean we didn't get that right again? Very, very interesting study related about breast cancer. And this is work coming out of Europe. We're not yet doing this in the United States, but this was reported at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium in San Antonio, Texas. The researcher, Jean-Yves Pierga, is a professor of medical oncology at Institut Curie and Université Paris-Descartes, France. And so what she found was very interesting. There are cells in the bloodstream called circulating cancer cells. It turns out that women who have metastatic disease will have circulating in their bloodstream cancer cells, and those can be found and measured in the blood. The number of cells that are located has a profound effect on the probability of a successful response to chemotherapy. In Dr. Pierga's study, 267 women who had metastatic breast cancer were receiving chemotherapy, and two-thirds of the women had one or more circulating tumor cells found, and 44% had five or more circulating tumor cells. At 2 years, in those who had five or more circulating tumor cells at baseline receiving the same therapy, 95% of them had had progression of their cancer, whereas only 70% of those with fewer cells. In a related story, women with no circulating tumor cells had a 5% relapse rate compared to 85% of those with circulating tumor cells. This is a huge difference, and it means that we really need to get this test up and running in this country as we make therapeutic decisions for patients. If your chance of relapse is so much greater with the circulating tumor cells, you would want to go after much more aggressive therapy with no circulating tumor cells. While I wouldn't go without any therapy at all, that might be okay, by the way, but we just don't have the data to support that kind of a radical jump at this point, particularly with the stakes that we're talking about, life or death. Still, choosing a less aggressive option, or maybe even choosing only hormone modulators, might make sense, particularly in people in already frail health, because the marginal benefit from heavy chemo is so much less in that group. So this is an extremely important prognostic identifier, and we need to insist that it be developed rapidly in this country, in my opinion. Let's go now to Jennifer in Pacific Grove. Hello, Jennifer. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I was hoping that you could give me a little direction about what type of person, what type of doc to go to get some diagnostics. For years now, I've had this issue going on, and it just keeps getting progressively more intense. And I'll get these periods of nausea where my stomach will feel upset and it will last for days. It'll go on for like 2 or 3 days and I can still eat. I don't throw up. In fact, I'll go through these weird waves of being hungry and then nauseous and hungry and then nauseous. Usually I feel better when I eat. Mm-hmm. Actually, I feel better when I eat. And then about 20 minutes after I eat, I'll start to feel queasy and sick again. And it will, like I said, I'll get these bouts that will last 2 or 3 days of time, mm-hmm. and then it'll just go away.
Go away.
I tried to figure out, is it cyclical, like with my period? Is it cyclical? You know, I tried to track it, like what mm-hmm. could this be, you know, cycling with hormones in some way?
Are you taking, anyway, are you taking any meds?
No.
Okay, go ahead.
Nothing. And it just seems like it's been going on now for almost 2 years, but now that the bouts are getting shorter and shorter, like, it's happening a lot more often, and now it's stretching out. So it's not like 2 or 3 days. Like, I've been feeling like this for about 8 or 9 days now.
Okay.
So I'm like, do I have a bacteria? Do I have a virus? Do I have an ulcer?
Actually, I think you're getting warm. You're getting warm there. My guess, and this is, again, an educated guess, but this sure. could be variant heartburn. And the variation part of variant heartburn is that you don't feel heartburn or pain, you feel nausea instead. The brain is misinterpreting the signal, and instead of giving you a pain interpretation, it's giving you a nausea interpretation. But what's driving it is cells in the lower esophagus that are crying out for help, and that cry is coming out as nausea. That would fit with the timing, getting better when you eat for a short period of time and then getting worse again. That is really a characteristic pattern for heartburn, and the timing is characteristic for heartburn. And when the stomach starts to digest what you've just eaten, the acid starts to increase, and as the acid increases and the stomach starts to churn, little bits of acid splash up through that open esophageal sphincter, and they get up to the esophagus, which doesn't have protective mucus. And so those cells scream, they say, ouch, and the ouch goes to the brain and comes out as nausea. So that's the dynamic. Using a strong dose of antacid would be a good test. So you would eat, feel the relief, start to feel the nausea, take a quarter cup of Maalox or Mylanta, a big dose of the liquid stuff, and see if that shifted it. If it improved the nausea, that would be support for this idea.
Okay.
It fits also with the timing of, you know, 3 days, and then it sort of heals itself, and you get back your seal on the lower esophageal sphincter, and then you aren't splashing acid anymore, so you don't get the nausea.
Huh. Well, I tried to track it also with, like, different food. Like, is it worse with different food? And, you know, I'm a coffee drinker. I'm trying to have less, but it's a really hard thing to give up.
If you go
that makes it worse.
If you go on my website, there is a list of anti-reflux rules, tricks of the trade, so to speak. And among them is a list of foods to avoid, foods and beverages to avoid. Things like acidy drinks, caffeine, alcohol, actually, because that relaxes the lower esophageal sphincter. And there's also a list of physical maneuvers you can do, elevating the head of the bed, timing how you consume your beverages compared to your food. And that's all right up there on the AskDrDawn.com website. Just go to the resources page and you'll be able to find it.
Well, now, so my just one other follow-up question to that is that, so this is like a forever thing now? Like, this is the way I'm going to be living my life? Or is this something that can heal and correct itself over time?
It can heal and correct itself over time if you can figure out what the drivers are. You might be overweight.
Okay.
If you're overweight, losing weight will definitely help. If you're not overweight, it could be some of the physical habits you have. Perhaps you wear a tight waistband or you lean over a surface. Perhaps you eat large amounts and with a lot of liquid, and you could modify that behavior. So there's things that you can do.
Perhaps your fitness instructor that does a lot of core exercise and is contracting their abdominals and diaphragm and all of that a lot.
And perhaps that individual also shovels down a whole bunch of water and then goes and does crunches.
Yes. All right.
So there's
well, thank
stuff.
You.
So go check out the website, and you might also Google gastroesophageal reflux disease. And by all means, try these things. Try the little test I mentioned with the heartburn. If you're continuing to have problems, eventually you're going to need to get scoped. Someone's going to need to look down there and be sure that you are, in fact, a very healthy fitness instructor who doesn't have an ulcer. But, you know, you can try these things first.
And the only way to know whether you have an ulcer is to do a scope, correct?
No, beyond a shadow of a doubt, yeah. A lot of times if the symptoms are characteristic enough and the person is positive for H. pylori on a breath test, for example, then we'll go ahead and treat empirically, which means we just treat as if it were true because the treatment is not that drastic.
And what about doing blood testing for different types of bacteria or parasites?
Well, the only thing you blood test for is H. pylori, and the presence of antibody to Helicobacter pylori means you had it at some point in the past, but it doesn't tell you whether you have a current infection. And there are a great many people out there with heartburn and gastritis and other sorts of uncomfortable stomach problems who don't have Helicobacter and don't get better when you treat.
Okay.
Gotta go.
That was very useful. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye. We've come to the end of another hour. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. This is Dr. Dawn saying, join me next week, and so long, and stay healthy.